next, the International
Connection
in color.
Good morning and welcome to the International Connection for March the 5th, 2006. It's very busy in here this morning, unusually busy. We have Mark in doing IWD work and helping me get some of my stuff in line to play this morning. I've got an interesting show, I think. A bit eclectic, you might say. Also, I should say that Daniel Bichard is here with me, and Phil Dilio was just packing things in after his program. So we're not alone this morning here, Sunday morning on CKLN. And so we lay on the cusp of International Women's Day programming, and we're transitioning from African Liberation Month. Now, last week, we had an all Harry Belafonte program. Now, that seemed to go over really well. So well, in fact, that I wish that I just had nonstop Harry Belafonte programming to work on over the next year. And furthermore, for Women's Liberation Month, I wish Harry Belafonte was a woman. But he's not. So, so riding out of African Liberation Month, CKLN is about to roll into new specialty programming celebrating International Women's Day. And today's International Connection manages to merge the two in unexpected and delightful ways, I hope. As we've been doing every 4 weeks since last November, Bob Dobbs and Mike Dyer's voices echo from the past as we dig into my own personal CKLN archive of selected material. And what stuff I selected, huh? This time, a program from October 10th, 1990. So I'll give you more explanation about that show in a minute. Then, around 9:45, this time courtesy of Mr. Tim Canale of www.maybrussel.com. Again, that's May, M-A-E, and Brussel, B-R-U-S-S-E-L-L.com. Out in, I think it's in San Jose, California. It's May Brussel in conversation with the flamboyant feminist Flo Kennedy, who was an African-American, so which neatly merges our African and women's programming tributes, I think, anyway. For this presentation, we dig further back into previously uncharted territory in the career of Mae Brussel. This is the earliest show I've ever heard. In fact, I haven't even had a chance to listen to this show yet. I'm just going to play it as is. So that's back to 1974, when her program was called Dialogue Conspiracy. And she later changed the title to World Watchers International, as you know. Evidently some pun on Weight Watchers International. So that'll be at 9:45 this morning. I would hope that you'll stay tuned for that. But first, back in 1990, CKLN broadcast a program on Wednesday nights and early Thursday mornings. And it was hosted by a man named Mike Dyer. And it ran for 2 hours. And as his guest, every couple of weeks, he would have Bob Dobbs. And you know Bob from our program. And I taped these shows because I thought that they were interesting. And it's from those tapes that I'm able to present these old programs. Because I think besides me and maybe a couple of other people, only Bob has tapes of these shows from the original broadcasts. Now, today's show is strange in the sense that it covers the topic of Twin Peaks. Now, Twin Peaks was a television program, a very strange television program from the late 80s, early 90s, and it was produced by David Lynch, the bizarre filmmaker who made, gosh, I can't remember the name of the film. But he did Dune. I think that was one of his worst films, or considered to be one of his worst films, critically. David Lynch was involved in this television program. And Bob was really into this show, and he seemed to think that lots of things in the program signaled that they were about him and the people around him, like Bob Marshall, Mike Dyer, all the people that Bob's wife they were all little signals that somehow David Lynch knew about Bob and the world of Bob and was putting it and using it as an influence for these programs, for these television programs. And Bob would watch very carefully and tape and analyze. And so a lot of the fans of this particular program would do the same. And thus, a two-hour program was born talking about the influences of this Twin Peaks television show. And I think maybe I'm not sure whether the feature film had come out at this point. They did make a theatrical feature film about it. So that's the background. Now, amazingly, and there is strange, Bob calls it xenochrony. Other people call it synchronicity. Strange intersections form with Bob in weird ways. And indeed, because we're going into International Women's Day, it's quite amazing as I was listening to this show that I picked totally randomly, there is some discussion about feminism and about women and their relationship to this particular program that Bob and Mike Dyer did. So I thought that was quite interesting. So without further ado, here for the next, believe it or not, 73 minutes, is a program from October the 10th, 1990, for those of you keeping track, making a spreadsheet of all of this. This has been edited quite severely from the original 2 hours in length, and it has been time compressed also to fit within our time schedule here. So here it is, Bob Dobbs, Mike Dyer, and you will hear the voices of the current host of CKLN's Unfortunate Sonic Casualties. I won't say who. I'll let you guess. Maybe we'll have a little quiz at the end. And also the producer of Broken Social Scene, the new band, actually makes an appearance in 1990 on this program. And probably other people that are famous. And there's even a mention of currently famous Canadian film director who somehow had intersections with Bob. Here it is, October 10th, 1990, the Bob Dobbs Mike Dyer program. That's not it.
In the Toronto Star, Saturday, September the 29th, the headline reads, How David Peterson Elected Bob Ray. And the subtitle is, A cellular phone call to Premier's boss prompted the decision that sank the campaign that shouldn't have been. It's a great article by Thomas Walcombe. And he goes on to cite the three mistakes that led to the downfall of David Peterson. Here's how he describes the first one. This is how he begins the article. It was 4 weeks into the provincial election campaign, and Premier David Peterson was speeding towards Cornwall. Peterson had a big decision to make. As it turned out, it would be the decision on which his campaign re-election hinged. Should he announce a cut in the provincial sales tax? The cut had been strongly urged by the Liberal Strategy Committee, the group of backroomers who were masterminding Peterson's campaign. But Treasurer Bob Nixon had been reluctant, and some aides argued that a tax cut now could backfire, that it would be seen as an attempt to bribe voters with their own money. So as Peterson rumbled along in his campaign bus, he pondered, until a call came in on the cellular phone. It was from Nixon. Do it, he told Peterson. Peterson did it, and the campaign was lost. That was August 22nd. That's what Mr. Walcombe has decided was what brought Peterson down, and that was the timing. That was August 22nd. Praise Premier Bob.
Laughing like a hyena. You should sue for slander. So anyway, that was a good article. I happened to meet Robert Huff on the weekend by chance. He thinks you're brilliant, but, well, you know, writers. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, Bob. This is Scott. I just got back into town Monday night at 9:30. I was in Montreal climbing a crane for Greenpeace. I got popped by the police. I missed a show, but someone taped Sherman Skolnick in the first half hour of the Axis channeling. I found it very rewarding. Thank you very much, Bob. I'll talk to you soon, maybe next show, unless you want to give me a call.
The Toronto Star Saturday magazine has on its cover The Word on the Street, the first annual Toronto book and magazine fair. And as usual, Philip Marchand, under the heading of Book, has an article there, and Philip, the figure, is returned to identify his ground. So he returns to the subject of Marshall McLuhan, and the article is one single page, with about a third of the page occupied by a photo of Marshall, gesturing with his hand, some sort of retrieval of tactility. Anyway, so he's gesturing away with his hand there, and the caption, which has probably been put in by the photo editor, it says, Marshall McLuhan, the man with the message. Well, at least they didn't say the medium is the message. They just show a picture of the medium. So, the man with the message. Anyway, Marshall goes through this fairly long-winded explanation there about the different types of media that are available to us today and how they affect us differently. And then he really gets to the substance of the matter in the very last paragraph. And here's what he says. Marshall himself was never entirely enamored of the new electronic media environment. His main point was that we needed a balance in our media diet, a heavy intake of print to counteract our absorption of television. We could really, if we wanted, have the best of both worlds. We could have the immediacy and involvement of the broadcast media with the detachment and the analytical stance fostered by print media. But large numbers of the young, in particular, are in danger of being swamped by television, which is extremely seductive. Not that Bob isn't seductive, of course, but I don't know what Philip's trying to get at here. It could be taken two ways. Here he's talking about a need. He's trying to retrieve an idea of Marshall's that we need a balance in our media diet. He's not talking about a media fast. He's not. I don't know if he's really talking about the kind of media ecology that's on your show. So the question is has Philip Marchand not been tuning into the program, not gotten onto the agenda, or is he listening to the Church of the Subgenius and putting out a contrary point of view? I think we need an explanation from Mr. Marchand.
Newsflash from the Hype Newsroom, Metropolis. Fold. That's right. Hype Magazine. Now Magazine's official competition. Advertising agents defected. Mixed corporate media. Woo!
Hey, I just thought, I don't know why I'm sharing this with you, but I just thought the funny thing is that this young lady takes her little baby to, like, the store, and the guy stands at the counter, and she gets cigarettes, and then he reaches over on the other side and gets pacifiers, and the baby takes the pacifier, and she takes a cigarette, and they both put them in their mouths and suck and get pacified.
Bob, it's Eric. I am very stumped here, and I can't find anybody else who can help me on this. I'm looking for a definition of ramsa. Give me a call tomorrow at work. This is driving me crazy. My manager is driving me crazy on this one.
Hey, Bobby. A couple of quick funny things. Just going through the secret diary of Laura Palmer, and it's written by Jennifer Lynch. I think there's a family relation there, daughter or something. Well, it looks like Bob's the main character in this. If you saw the last Twin Peaks, then you'll know that we've discovered Bob is actually the exist. And in here, he's Laura's midnight rapist. Really scares her a lot and lives inside her head. So maybe you should just cut that out, eh, Bob? And she says also about Bob, his name is a warning in itself. Beware of Bob, B-O-B. And speaking of beware, we can go right over to the new eye-opener, Ryerson's Weekly. And we got two articles, one on page 3, hate mongers out front of Jorgensen Hall. And then we go to the editorial, and it's LaRouche La Quack. So they got their anti-LaRouche propaganda out in full force ever since you mentioned it on the last show. And they had to respond pretty quickly. Bye, Bob.
Over and over about fire. And then she said, Would you like to play with fire, little boy? Would you like to play with Bob? Would you like to play with Bob?
What does she mean by that?
I don't know. Laura said a lot of nutty stuff. Half the time, just went right by you. This stuck, though.
Messages for Bob Marshall. My name is David Oansi. I'm from Brave New Wave, CBC Montreal. I was trying to get the number for Reverend Ivan Stang, and I was given your number by Mike Dyer. If you could please call me back, it would be terrific. Area code is 514-597-4490. I'll be here until 9 o'clock tonight, and if not, I'll be in tomorrow from 1 to 9. Time presently is 5:30. Thank you very much.
So much to digest, so little time to do it. Bob, welcome. Welcome, listeners, to the Church of the Subgenius. It's another Wednesday night. Good to have you here.
Well, it always gets exciting and escalated in October, the 10th month.
Mm-hmm.
What's tonight, the 10th? 10-10.
Yes.
Secret Council 10 night, I guess.
Can I point out right at the very beginning of tonight's show that you're on tonight, as always, as per our schedule, but you will be in next week as well, because next week, as many of our listeners know, is fundraising, right in the middle of fundraising. Next week is our show, and I think it's important that you come down during that fundraising segment. And I'd like to put an open invitation out to all our listeners and to the people who call. You're more than welcome to come down and join. And it's a lot of fun, isn't it, Bob?
Certainly is. And, of course, I'll be making predictions as it has been requested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the help of the Exes.
Yeah, and with the help of your pledges as well.
Yes, and like last year, we raised a lot of money, and I think we helped put CKL over the top, and I expect the church members to do it again this year. We're going for a big chunk to this time.
We're counting on them.
Did you say everybody can come down?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Anyone who can come down or who wants to, you're more than welcome. If you have any questions about how to get here, if you haven't been here before, we can give you directions.
Come on down and fire walk with Bob.
Yeah, that's a special occasion next week, fundraising. So that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, the phone numbers are 595-1655 or 1478 or 1479.
Right.
If you want to get in on the act right away, go discurrent with Bob.
And I know we have new listeners as well.
We do?
I know we do.
Oh, okay.
I just feel it.
All right. Now, the thing is, there was so much material in those messages that I took notes for the first time, just to remind me.
Yeah.
Is that Kent in the background?
I think it's Peter.
Yeah. Okay. I know that the August 22nd show was a very profound, moving, intense, and well-manipulated show by yourself, and I think we really shook up the area, and I think George is wise to note the article in the paper noticing the effect of August 22nd on Peterson. That's an important point. I like the way the next caller, Ed, pointed out that he talked to Robert Hoff, who wrote the article on Mike and I and Connie in this magazine. It's on the stands now. He says, Robert thinks I'm brilliant, but... And then Ed goes, you know writers. What do you think he means by that, Mike? They've got to be, what? They can't merge, right? They got to keep detached. Right?
Show their objectivity.
Yeah, their detachment. So he ain't going to get involved in the emotion of multitude.
Yeah.
So it's right there, and I think that's what Edward meant.
In fact, if we could just clarify, it was in fact Robert who laughed like a hyena that night. I remember that night vividly. He was slapping his knee and laughing like a hyena, and he just passed that action on to you. So let's clarify that right now.
He was right. He mixed the truth there. He was right that right after the show, I went running into you and said, great show, Mike. You know, fine work. And he had me slapping my knee. Well, you're right. It was Robert who was slapping his knee. I was laughing all the way through the show. It's just that Mike has a filter and filters that out. You think the Bob image on Twin Peaks is dangerous. Look at me laughing in this studio all through the two-hour show. One other point about Hoff. I called him up and congratulated him on the article. Excellent article. I said it was riddled with errors. But since he was dealing with an awesome topic, his probe, his distillation was profound and well done.
Mm-hmm.
So kudos to Robert Hoff.
And the continuing denial of Adam Egoyan, his...
It was over. Yeah. I mean, I got him on tape. We'll play it some night. Me demanding Adam Egoyan to eat a plum in the kitchen. He wouldn't eat my plum. Then Scott, he liked the Axis press conference, and he wants to get a tape. Did he mention? I think he wanted to know if he could get a tape. Well, Kent will be looking after that, it seems. So call Kent later, Scott, if you want to get a copy of the press conference. Also, we'll be off... maybe we'll offer it as a prize next week. That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to offer. Oh, okay. Kent's offering it as a prize, and so is Wayne Morris on International Connection. So you can see how valuable that press conference was. Many programmers offering it as a prize. Again, paid for by Bob, $500, and, you know, there it is, helping the station get by with their prizes. Let's see, Jerry, Hype Magazine, adds, he said the advertising agent... The advertising executive or the person who gets the ads at Metropolis Magazine. Good news there. She happened to be dating Dante, the publisher of... just a minute, Kent there. Kent's just coming in here. Anyways, Dante, the publisher of... we on, Mike? Yeah, we're on. Dante, the publisher of...
it likes me just a little too much.
Yeah, the mic, Kent's gravity is attracting the microphone. Hold it there. It looks like we can't get this Dante fact out. Dante, the publisher of Hype, was dating the advertising businesswoman, person who got the clients for Metropolis. I guess she was laid off when Metropolis went down, so Hype got her. So me being the spiritual advisor of that magazine, it looks like the slack is pouring in. They may outdo now with their fine example of graphic psychology, which Mike doesn't appreciate. And then what else? I like Jerry's use of the mixed corporate media phrase. Very good. Mixing corporate media. Hype is attempting to put on a corporate audience, and they hijack some people from the other corporate medium, Metropolis. Dave pointing out about the people, the mother and the baby sucking on things, right? That's gravity. Earth sucks, right? There it is. It's a heavy psychological collective unconscious conditioning, this sucking apparatus, and it seems that humans like to suck from birth, from womb to tomb, right? Womb to tomb. You see, Eric left a message. He's getting hassled by his manager. Came to Bob. Bob explained it, and I was listening to the archives, and we actually talked about Ramtha last show, and Eric needed to know what Ramtha was. The drink sounds, nice interval. Someone, did you get those drink sounds like, you know, ice in a glass? That was sort of maybe someone just sitting back, having some liquid frop and feeling slack and said, I got to tell Bob this. So they call up and shake the glass in the tape recorder. You know, we're going to get into Twin Peaks tonight. That's very important. The results are in. It's obviously about Mike and Bob. And if you've seen the last two shows, the premiere of the second series and last Saturday show, you know that I think we can analyze now why the women for this church in Toronto are absent. Where are the women?
I think we've got
the answer now with Laura's diary, but I'll get into that a little later. Thanks to Jim for the quotes from Twin Peaks, Play with Bob, Play with Fire, and the second quote from about the third show of the first series, where in the dream of Cooper, the man, the wizard Mike, is talking like the interval man, talking about the magician yearning mm-hmm. for being between two worlds, right?
There's a different tone to the new series, isn't there?
Well,
it's a different series.
Yeah, Jerry told me the ratings went way down.
Oh, I can believe it.
Yeah, it's getting serious because that's what we're going to talk about. So the last item was from Dave on Oancia, O-A-N-C-I-A. He's right. Like he owns the CIA, He's from Montreal. He has the gall to call Mike and ask for Stang's phone number. The American Church. This is a Canadian organization, the CBC, and they're looking for the American stalwart. So I thank Mike for telling me about this. I called the guy. He got a call from Bob Dobbs. He couldn't believe it. And I told him he ain't going to get Stang's phone number until he reviews the material that's going on here in Toronto. All right? So I sent him the stuff. He's going to get back to me. He isn't going to fool me. He's going to say, yeah, this is very good stuff, Mr. Dobbs. Certainly we'll use it in the program. Just give us Stang's number. We ain't going to ever give him Stang's number. Okay? So that just shows you where the CBC's at, eh? What's the show called? Beneath the Waves or something?
Brave New Waves.
Brave New Waves? Yeah, sure. They got to read a little Stephen Hawking and find out about the wavicle. You know, half wave, half particle. That's what we are here, right? Half ego, half collective merging.
I was once accused by Dave of Baldwin Foods of having a big ego. Well, that's the particle level of matter. And then there's the wavicle, or the wave part of matter. And what's that? That's the electric water we're swimming in. And we can't tell who's who. You can't tell whether Mike or Bob is running the show, or even if it's on tape.
We have to get the archives to check this out.
Okay, could you just stop the undertow for a second? Oh, let's listen to it.
Remember, we have to get the archives to check this out. Use it. We have to get the archives to check this out.
Horn is coming, right?
No, sir.
We have.
Yes, sir. And,
you know how many time zones they have?
Yes, sir. Four. No, sir. I never really studied that out.
Use it. We have to get the archives to check this out. You said something about time zones in the Soviet Union in your, you know, scattered pre-Bob realization state of mind before Czechoslovakia
right.
happened. Yeah,
right.
When you're confused, you know, under the influence
well,
of Staines.
There's only eight now.
Under the influence of Staines Church. Under the influence of Staines Church. Under the influence of Staines Church. Under the influence of Staines Church.
That's what we can do. We can go anywhere because we live here. We can go anywhere else.
But not only the right of free travel, I'm saying the 11th.
Under the influence of Staines Church. 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 And I think I wanted to remind you that I checked it out and I think there were 11. I checked it out and I think there were 11. I checked it out and I think there were 11.
I can believe that. I'm a firm believer.
Mike, where's this from? This is awesome. Again, your technical manipulation is Manipian-like.
I'd like to take credit for it, but it's from George.
Oh, it's a local job.
Another George tip.
George in Toronto.
Yeah.
The Church of George. Now, did he get it from someone else?
Not now.
He might have got it from someone else.
This is from our archives.
Well, where did he get... he did this last year. He did it for the fundraising last year. He put together a tape. So this is him taking some stuff from a subgenius Dallas tape, you know, a couple of years ago. The time zone thing. Remember that? And put it up above. Nice editing. And again, you timed it right in. Did you know this was about Stang? We just talked about CBC and Stang, and you put this in. This is the kind of skill that you psychically come up with.
Just let it happen, Bob.
Yeah.
Don't question.
Okay, can we have some silence for a second? I think the first show pointed out the significance of Bob and proved that Blue Velvet was about, and a letter to Bob Marshall, and Twin Peaks is a letter... message warning to Mike and Bob, with Bob as the hidden ground. Twin Peaks, the whole piece, the whole epic, is a message to Bob. Cooper plays the role of Bob Marshall, you know, grown up. And of course, the aspect of Bob Marshall, Agent Cooper, getting in touch with the aliens is obvious now, with the giant showing up occasionally. And this is the axis, this is the Bob Dobbs theme, the role of Bob Dobbs, which Bob Marshall is, what, evolving to, becoming Bob Dobbs? But see, his problem is that he's torn between these media archetypes of the old nature and the new nature. And at the same time, he's seen aspects of himself in every character in the cast, all right? All right, now, what is the theme that Twin Peaks is going to freak people out with? It's become obvious that David Lynch is dealing on a perfect pitch sensitivity with the preoccupation of the latter 80s and into the 90s, the new age psychic obsession. Because if you think of it, more and more, most of the characters involve a psychic activity in one way or another. Now, the psychic activity is obviously expressed in our show here with the Exus channeling through a person named Michael. See, that's what's interesting. The channel for the Exus, in certain points, when I'm just talking to them, is a man named Michael. And so there's a psychic element in our show, and as Dave Bernard said at the staff meeting, he says, Bob, going to feature any predictions, you know, at the fundraising next week. This psychic anticipatory effect of our theater we do here, our political campaign slash theater, and or both sign, right? And the fact is that if you re-listen to the tapes, you can tell that Mike is putting stuff in his embeds, what we call the undertow, that can only be done psychically because he doesn't know what's going to be talked about, but he can juxtapose items that fit with what's being talked about. I don't know how he does it, but this is the psychic level of this show. So this is why Twin Peaks is really talking to what we're doing here. See, where are the women for this show? Where are the women in the Church of the Subgenius, Solar Government Headquarters, every second Wednesday here in Toronto? That's the question we're all wondering. Well, I'm going to get to that in a minute, but that's what that... See, Laura is there. Laura is there. She's not dead. Another big concern in the psychic world, in the Aquarian world, is the New Age world, is UFOs. Now, there's a real funny joke here by David Lynch. You see, we've talked about Bill Cooper on the show. I don't know if you... Do you remember us talking about him?
Yeah.
He's the maniac running around exposing the MJ-12 cover-up, saying that George Bush and the Trilateral Commission, Kissinger and Rockefeller, have been dealing with aliens since, like, the 40s and abducting thousands of peoples, and secretly has been making deals with the aliens so that they could get technology from them and keeping it for themselves, the Trilaterals. Well, Hype magazine, in its inaugural issue, featured the Bill Cooper... summons to George Bush to come to court, and this was in November 89. He summoned George Bush officially to come to court to deal with Bill Cooper's charges that George Bush and his cohorts have created a treasonous government cooperating with the alien nation. Okay, so you've got, this is Bill Cooper. All right, now, Mike, to try to be patient with this, this isn't University of Toronto. This is not a funnel seminar. This is significant, I think, because the world is hanging on the abyss of a mythic collapse, and I think we need to have this explained, because I think David Lynch's program is being used at this point, all right? And I think it was used in the first series, but now they don't know how to use it, so they're going to discourage an audience. So Bill Cooper... And this is Hype magazine, Bob's spiritual advisor for it. They show the relevance of Cooper, and they put it on the cover of their inaugural issue, and you have the aliens communicating to Dale Cooper. So you have a satire on the UFO cult via the name Dale Cooper about the Bill Cooper phenomenon. He is stirring up a lot of problems. Pretty well about now he's been dismissed, but we played The Exus talking about Cooper about a month ago, maybe on the August 22nd show. See, this is the thing, what Lynch is talking about. I mean, maybe they were scripting this out on August 22nd, Lynch and them working this out, this Cooper element, while we're playing the real stuff here on the show. We had the real aliens, The Exus from the booties, talking about Bill Cooper and showing how he was a fraud. So this is, you see the mirror? Do you see how it's hard to see not myself there? It's hard not to see you and me there, Mike? Because look at the Mike and Bob dialectic. We know Mike, the one-armed shoe salesman. You know, he's the convert. He's trying to get back into the pink reality. He's fighting hard to do. He has to be a shoe salesman because he won't kill a game. Bob vowed he'd kill a game, right? Now, you remember the mirror of that is little Bobby and Bobby Briggs and... and little Mike. Now, remember Mike? You remember those two little guys? And remember how Mike quit and we haven't seen him since? He got scared by Leo's dope deal? Okay, so Mike dropped out. Meanwhile, that mirrors the one-armed guy, Mike the Wizard, dropping out. The one who said on Jim's quote at the beginning that the magician longs to view the future past between two worlds. That's the interval. There's a bunch of other points here, Mike. Mike is really getting frustrated here with me. He thinks I'm going on too long.
Hello. Hi. You on the air?
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, good. I'm on the air. Right. I just wanted to point out a couple of things. On some level, the pinks at ABC must know that there is this message embedded into the whole thing of Twin Peaks. Otherwise, they wouldn't have put the show on at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night to reach less of an audience, because who's going to stay home on Saturday night? Who has got the energy to to just sit at home and say, I'm going to cancel Saturday night and sit and watch Twin Peaks, unless they're tied into the electronics and videotape everything, but, you know, as most fanatics will do. But in any case, the point being that all of the hype that's happened after the first season has made... is kind of making the message reach a wider audience through, again, the insinuation of all the various media forms. And I think someone picked up on that. Otherwise, they wouldn't have really put it into dead air time, which is Saturday night. I don't think you could ever think of a show that existed on Saturday night that survived. So I think that really this is it. I mean, if Lynch has got a message to say, or if he's being used, he's going to have to do it soon, because if this survives by Christmas, I'll be quite surprised. And really, I think the point that I'm trying to make is somebody knows that, and that's why it got stuck on where it did get stuck on.
Well, you're 122% correct. There is a conspiracy, because Lynch is talking about the discarnate state, and your metaphor of putting it on dead air is the point. You cannot have that show being as effective as it was in the first series when everybody's watching it live and feeling it live. Now, the fanatics will tape it, but that's not the same as sharing it live on the air when it's happening, the psychic interplay and the collective consciousness,
right? Well, of course not, because everybody's doing it at the same time, and there's that whole body of energy that's connecting with that particular experience.
Right, and that, is that true, that if you put a show on Saturday night, it's a way of killing it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've watched plenty of TV in my time, and I can't remember a successful show on it Saturday night. I do remember that when they decided to kill Star Trek, they stuck it on at 10 o'clock Friday night. And everybody knew in the cast that when it got stuck on that slot, that they were doomed.
So I think LaRouche, David Lynch, got this little LaRouche poster here. At this point, Lynch, I think he was genuinely surprised at the success of the show, because this show was a project that he was seriously creating, and he had his agenda, and it's going to be carried out. I think the agenda will be completed at the end of the series, and we won't need to do it. It'll be a tableau of two series, right?
Well, I certainly hope so. Otherwise, we're going to be seeing more Obsession commercials directed by Lynch, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which is kind of depressing on one hand.
That's right. Now, the thing is, this is really relevant that you're talking about they got to kill the live discarnate effect. And that's the significance of every media form miming what goes on here at CKLN and why we should be supported in a public level of donations. Because in any other media archetype, you will not be able to communicate the discarnate effect and create the subgenius church effect, no matter how conniving you are, because the tetrad managers will be able to do what they do to Lynch.
Well, certainly, because, like, if anything new and exciting, quote-unquote, is going to come on, well, actually, it won't happen anymore, because they'll say, well, look at what happened with Twin Peaks in the second year. It completely and totally bombed, so why bother? Why bother doing anything interesting? Let's just give them all the crap that they want to see, that we want to show in any case that, you know, requires the mentality of basically a piece of wood in order to watch it.
Get the log.
We'll go ahead and give them more of that, because obviously it's a failure, and they'll just point to the Lynch experience as like, well, we gave it a shot, folks, but we know what you really want to hear.
Okay, now
we'll
listen.
Give it to you.
Yeah, it's a point that comes to mind is that we can have room for optimism, because the homeopathic effect of Mike and I in the church here is proven, because you've got a TV series that everybody was involved in the spring that was about me, all right? And now that never could have been done before. So that shows you the evolution of the solar government exposure I'm putting into this, and that I will be acknowledged and Bob Rule will come, because this was the joke that Lynch realized.
Well, it's either homeopathic or some kind of Bach flower essence, you know, because it's working on more of an emotional level than a healing level, I think.
Yeah, well, now that's I think that maybe that's why they wanted to use Lynch in the first case, was to create some paranoia leading up to the wonderful autumn season we have in the mixed corporate media solar theater we have here, with paranoia running amok everywhere, eh?
Exactly.
I'll tell you some interesting thing. We do a lot of with the number 22. And have you read Laura Palmer's diary? Have you seen it?
No, it's in hardback. Too much money.
Oh, no, paperback at the world's biggest bookstore.
Oh, okay.
I've
never
seen it in hardback.
But, I'm on my way.
Yeah, and the point is that she was born on July 22nd, 1972.
Oh, praise Bob.
Yeah, you know about the 22 stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, now the point is, on July 22nd, in 1972, the Holy Office, our Holy Office here, Mae Brussel, that was when she got involved on that day with Paul Krasner and John Lennon and Yoko Ono to get the money to publish the first realist dealing with Mae Brussel's material, that upstage Woodward and Bernstein, on that day, July 22nd, 1972. And you know what else happened on that day? The Mae Brussel's the top-down analyst. The bottom-up analyst, Marshall McLuhan, his book, which deals with the conspiracy called Take Today, The Executive is Dropout, was released on July 22nd, 1972. Now, of course, Lynch probably doesn't know this, but he's talking about our church and our important dates.
It's not important that he knows it.
That's right. That's right. He's channeling.
That's right.
And so there's the next metaphor, is that he is dealing with his own scenario, yet it strikes a chord. He knows at a certain level that he's echoing what the concerns of Americans are going into the 90s, but he doesn't know that the answer is here, in the form of a double duty in tarot bang here on CKLN.
And also, it doesn't really matter, all the hype and all that kind of stuff, because in a sense, no matter how many people get touched by Bob, in whatever level, it still hits. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter if a lot of people don't understand what's really going on. I mean, it doesn't really matter if they're just going to try and figure out who did Laura Palmer in, and that's all they care about, really. All they care about is plot. That doesn't matter, because all of that is kind of hitting them on a psychic, all of the real message is hitting them on a psychic level anyways.
That's right, and cliche awareness is the most avant-garde state today, and it's advisable that people remain unaware today, considering the fire we're walking in, all right? Now, I want to tell you the final clincher, Mike, that proves this is about Bob, is one of Bob's best jokes. One of my greatest hits a couple of years ago was when I pointed out
the movie They Live. Did you ever see that movie?
No.
By, what's his name, Carpenter, Mike? John Carpenter, was he the director? Excellent movie, and in it, the character sees the Orwellian nightmare that the planet Earth is in by putting on sunglasses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, the week that came out, and it was pulled pretty quickly down here at Eaton's, but a lot of subgeniuses saw it, the week that it came out, Roy Orbison died.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, he was notorious for being the first pop singer, maybe,
to wear sunglasses.
Now, this is a great Bob joke. Many people understood Bob's pattern recognition for the first time when they saw how Bob could connect popular culture events with political conspiracies. Well, what happens here in the premiere of the second series? Donna
puts sunglasses on.
And they change. And it's Laura's sunglasses. So Laura went through the They Live experience a few years ago, and that's what happened to her. She got involved with Bob. Isn't that amazing?
That is simply amazing.
Yeah, and I think that David Lynch knows that, and that's a little joke to his friend John Carpenter.
I think a lot of it is a little joke.
Yeah, among filmmakers, that's right.
Exactly.
I mean, I've asked Mike to give me some references to other films. Apparently there are, but I haven't heard anybody give me the quotes that he's actually referring to in previous 40s movies or whatever.
I think if you look more closely, there's a lot of that. There was an awful lot of that, obviously, in Wild at Heart.
Yeah, that's true. That was almost too obvious.
Yeah.
That may be... why was it so obvious there? I think that movie failed compared to Blue Velvet and...
It just wasn't very subtle, that's all.
Yeah, why would... maybe what? What was he trying to get rid of the subtlety he was dealing with in Twin Peaks, so he went to the other end?
I think at some level it's just kind of... you've got to wonder about Lynch, you know? If he's really... if time management and financial aspects didn't somehow overwhelm the entire, you know, process of putting down what he wanted to put down.
In Wild at Heart.
I'd say so, because it had me going for the first two-thirds, but then all of a sudden, you know, it was like, okay, let's get this over with.
Okay, so I'll tell you an amazing theme that's going on and how major art forms echo what's going on here at CKLN. You juxtapose Wild at Heart with the new movie Goodfellas. Have you seen that?
No.
Okay, well, Wild at Heart is about... of course, me and Connie in our early days, and then recent paranoid situations we were in. But the
New Mexico, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. You know about that?
Oh, of course.
Do I know you?
No. No, I know Connie.
Oh, okay. You work with... you are... you help by Connie.
I'm helped by Connie, yeah.
Are you... you got a birthday tomorrow?
No. Oh,
okay.
I'm a master of hyperslack, though.
Okay.
Which is actually kind of interesting, because there's an awful lot of hyperslack in Twin Peaks as well. I mean, certainly, when Cooper does say that what you need to do is give yourself a present every day, a little surprise, not to plan it, but
let
it happen spontaneously.
Yeah.
I mean, I just looked at that and said, well, you know...
Even Major, the UFO guy, the Major has slack. His aphorisms are very profound. Remember he said he liked his medals because they were their own achievement.
And that's
that
right.
Pride got in the way.
Pride gets in the way.
I've never heard that said before. That's almost as good as our slogan last show, which was, do whatever you want as long as it hurts somebody.
Yeah.
Are you the guy who teaches school in Toronto?
Something like that, yeah.
Hey, Mike, this is the guy who overhears kids in his high school saying they heard Bob last night, and he listens to them, eavesdrops on them talking about Bob, and they would never suspect their teacher was joining in.
But there is Bob papered all over my walls.
Yeah, the pink Bob.
No, the real Bob.
Where can we get some of that?
Well, it's he's papered all over my walls. That's all I can say right now.
Okay, well...
there's Bob staring at the window of my room every day.
Okay, now the point about Goodfellas is that that's not about me and Connie. That's about my evil twin brother, Dick Dobbs.
Oh, yes.
And his wife, Karen. Not Carolyn, Karen.
Right.
And so check out Goodfellas. You'll see the sorry pink state that my brother Dick has gotten into in the last couple of years under the witness protection program since I moved into control of the tetradic process on March 88.
There might be some reference in that in the Three-Fisted Tales as well.
Oh, yeah. See, the Three-Fisted Tales, you've read the Ivan Stang story.
Right.
Yeah, that's the that's a pretty accurate description of my and Connie's life through all time. I'd recommend that story. And John Shirley's story is good, too.
Yeah.
John Shirley, I think Mike is interviewed in a new Mondo 2000 magazine, or in a recent issue, anyways. He's a good joint writer. Okay, Jack, thanks for the call.
Okay. Have a good evening, Bob.
Thank you. So, Mike, I'll get it up too loud, eh? Okay.
Yes, a little too loud.
I'm sorry, Mike, to be going on, but it has to be done.
Well, it's okay. You just seem to be going on a lot tonight. We've missed a few phone calls. And, you know.
Any more?
Yeah, there is, actually. Well, no, let me just... yeah, so, you are talkative tonight.
About Twin Peaks, because I think it's exciting that I said 2 months ago that the dream in... if you see the phone, just stop me. I mean, I'll...
Well, the phone's been, it's been on hold for the last 20 minutes, so...
Well, is there someone there now?
Yeah, we've had callers waiting all night, Bob, so let's stop talking so much.
Yeah,
and,
okay. Yeah, I'm with you on this.
Okay, thank you.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. Oh, hi, Edward.
Hi. You'll be happy to hear I want to talk about the Twin Peaks.
What a surprise.
There was two things. One was... how we perceive the media, medium of television. I'll get that out of the way first. I think it's a secondary one, and that is network viewership's down to 61%, supposedly. Like, whereas once, all TV watchers were tuned into the networks. As recently as the early 80s, it was 98% or something of all viewers would be tuned into the networks. So this cultishness of Twin Peaks is, it's now the norm for TV. I mean, there were some great Saturday night shows, Hockey Night in Canada, Sid Caesar, Jackie Gleason, Saturday Night Live, but they were, you know, they're mass generic products of the last 30 years of TV. So this cultishness, Kent and I just jammed a way to watch Twin Peaks next summer on Toronto Island. We'll have a Twin Peaks picnic, and everyone will come, will bring their chapter they've taped. Some will have the commercials on, some have taken the commercials off. And we'll get a couple of long extension cords going to two separate trees on the island. And we can start the Twin Peaks anytime, you know. You just, the early people can get there and watch the first chapter, and they'll watch the second chapter. And the latecomers, they can go over to the other TV, and they'll watch the first chapter and the second chapter. And I was saying to Kent, I'll hear a female voice say, "What? You're watching TV under a tree on a day like this?" Well, she goes off and plays Frisbee with the other people who don't want to watch TV under a tree. This is an interesting mutation of how to watch network television, don't you think?
No.
Well, I...
That doesn't sound very exciting, but Kent just walked in. Maybe he could support you, Edward.
Well, I do support him. I think this will be a blast.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you guys look after that, eh?
Yes,
I'll probably...
Twin Peaks picnic next July 22nd.
That would be the... why don't you make it 1992 and have the 20th anniversary of Laura's death? Laura's birth.
Yeah, we could do that.
Make it 2 years, and I may have time in 1992 to join in, because I've got such a busy year over the next 20 months, well, yeah, at least 12 months, with affairs in Washington. I have to, I can't really, it doesn't appeal to me at this point, probably because I can't put my energy into it.
Yeah. You have to bear with some of your followers, disciples, whatever we are, Bob, because, you know, we're not as dematerialized as you, and... sometimes we have to go and do bodily things, you know, like take out the garbage and go to picnics and stuff, you know.
Well, okay, I'll make a donation to it then. Yeah. I can probably get the foundation, the Doctors for Bob Institute, to make a donation to it for funding, because the Ontario government's not going to give any money for that. And don't let Stang take advantage of it as a divival, okay? There's no way, even though Mike used to have Stang up here. He wanted to have Stang up here for a divival, but I don't think Mike is into that anymore. What do you think, Mike? No, Mike says no, he wouldn't want to do that. So, yeah, no problem. As long as you don't bring Stang in, go ahead with it.
Now, one other thing, Bob, about your what can we call it, a fluid state? I mean, you are a woman. You are,
I'm a murderer. I'm a male. I'm an insect. I'm every aspect of the human dimension is art form.
Okay.
That's the content, right?
Okay. Now, the female energy that you manifest.
Yeah.
I have a little... trace of that. I went steady with a feminist for about 5 years. No, that's hard to do, to go steady with a girlfriend who was a feminist. So I'll always be, part of my consciousness will be, I will be a radical feminist in part, you know, for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And I'm partly grateful to her for that. But so looking at David Lynch from that point of view, which I think, you know, there was some radical feminist looking at, say, something like Hitchcock, woman as victim. You know, you do that if you're a filmmaker since Silent Days for two reasons. One, you make the women in the audience nervous because they identify with the woman as victim. And also you pull some cords to the men in the audience. All men want to be heroes and save the women and children first.
Yeah.
So that's just a given component of film and a lot of television. Resonating fiction. Of the body, but with Lynch, there's some funny mixture of
of transcendence and repugnance about female energy. The birds in Blue Velvet were first introduced to the audience. It was Laura Dern shyly confessing a private dream. I think it was about robins as a harbinger of bliss.
Yeah, can you hear me, Ed? Mic up a little clear?
Yeah, fine.
I just didn't know the sensitivity. Yeah, that's a very good point. I forgot that. The robin metaphor, yeah.
And then at the end was a plastic, forced, happy ending. A robin came in as a harbinger of happiness, happy ending. Laura Dern's face was just so radiant. And Kyle MacLachlan, what was his name in that film, was in Blue Velvet? He was the pre-Dale, okay, in that film. They look at the robin on the suburban kitchen windowsill, and it looks so beautiful, and the light was very Spielbergian, very fake, and the bird was fake. It looked like a wind-up bird you could buy in Spadina in Chinatown.
Yeah.
So here was when Lynch first chose birds as a metaphor for some kind of transcending of the evil that had gripped this small town, and then at the end it was a pretty fake bird. You know, it wasn't as good as hearing about the girl's dream in the convertible.
Yeah, well, in Wild at Heart, the Laura Dern character talks to Nicolas Cage about how his bird talks to him. His penis.
Oh.
Okay, now look at the metaphor on penis. And remember, Bob is a discarnate penis rubbed all the time in a state of ecstasy, you know, because of the tactile rub I'm getting, right, constantly. Think of the bird as a sexual organ. And then how it gravitates between transcendent source to wooden source.
Transcendent source to wooden source.
The dildo. You know, in Arizona, they have a new law now that you cannot have more than 5 dildos in your home. That is an actual legislated law in Arizona.
I won't ask how that came about. It must have been fun to in committee in the Arizona legislature to be discussing that one anyway.
I hope that Lynch is not falling into the Jungian trap of the anima and the animus. You know about that.
Yeah.
The feminine and the masculine, which William Irwin Thompson, to counter LaRouche, runs amok with, and LaRouche takes the other end and makes sure none of that Jungian stuff gets less than a satanic mythology, right? So you got that dialectic. I'm hoping Lynch is not a Jungian, but I think probably why you can't put your hand, eyes on the borderline here is because it's not Jungian, and he's showing the discarnate effect that we are not male or female anymore. And therefore, you have this blurring of intimacies and tendencies in the characters.
The time-honored exercise. Blurring of tendencies. Yeah, because Henry the Eraserhead came to mind. He looked across the room in that film and he saw a dog suckling little baby dogs, a mother dog. And he knew somewhere inside, and the audience knew it was coming, that his girlfriend was pregnant. Now, remember that anxiety about pregnancy in the first film? And that's another thing about nobody points out that it's a coincidence except the viewer. That's one other thing about the psychic theme of a lot of what you were talking about was that, you know, characters have different degrees of psychic ability, but it's kind of inspiring that we in the audience, we feel psychic. We knew Dale Cooper was going to get shot. We just knew it from the third last commercial.
A good point. Now, the psychic thing is the feminine energy. We'll call it right hemisphere. Traditionally, under matriarchal conditions, people were psychic, okay? And they did it for survival, too. Yeah. They had to know what was over the horizon. Now, you take this psychic theme, which is the feminine. Now, the feminine gets slayed in this series. The fire gets slayed by the new fire, the electric fire. So the owl, if you think of the owl as a figure of wisdom, you can take the feminine wisdom. And the owl is not what it seems. I see this is where Lynch is going beyond the Jungian dialectic. It's the feminine itself, which is the electric discarnate state, the fire, which we are all induced and seduced by, is being slaughtered, because the new situation of discarnate man is discarnate being is a state of post-psychicness, a state of making, where it's a hard situation under our autonomous situation to match with anything. And psychic matching on the psychic level is the last gasp of matching. It's to have a psychic synchronicity, right?
The last gasp of matching?
Yeah, it's a grasping and using the most deepest instincts to match with someone else and match your reality with them through the various psychic abilities. That is the last gasp of matching. And that's why psychic behavior is a 19th century phenomenon, if you think of the 19th century as a visually biased matching environment. We are beyond the psychic situation. And then the metaphor there of Twin Peaks is another element of the perfect pitch resonance that Lynch is consciously or unconsciously, as Jack pointed out, not important. He is showing the post-electric situation we're in of the search for human scale. And Twin Peaks comes back as a, not a search for roots, but is hoiked up as a model for the desire, the anticipation of community again.
There's such an apocalyptic mood these days, Bob. So when you say last gasp of matching, like, I get an overwhelming feeling of, you know, 5 billion non-communicating humans on a Tower of Babel.
Yeah, but the good news is that we are electrically fused. We are merged into that erogenous electronic discarnate zone. So this diversity, this confusion, this babel is now acceptable. That's why the cliche becomes archetype, something that Jack said earlier about the normal is just as insightful. That's why Lynch doesn't have to know what he's doing. You can probe. I mean, Mike doesn't know what he's doing on this show. I do know, but I have to pretend I don't know. But we can create magic anyways. So ordinary awareness is source of inspiration more than the high-intensity, you know, Tim Leary's Evolve the consciousness. What was that phrase in the 60s, expand your consciousness? You know, that kind of scenario is not relevant to the electronic blast. It serves as an ersatz or fake anti-environment, and expanding your consciousness will become come back as a temporary mood need, but it'll be bounced off the need for ordinariness. This is where Alan Watts comes in, right? He celebrated the ordinary awareness.
The lower jaw.
Did you concur with that, or?
No, I think that's just an effect of the electric environment. Oh. I think that the superior form of awareness is possible, but it's not in any recognized tradition. That's why I have a monopoly on the situation. It's hard to explain this sense of detachment and involvement, which is not expressed by either of those words.
Mike,
is the interval. All right, this interval state that I'm in, this slack state is what is necessary to survive today. And you're talking about the apocalypse that is the dominant mood today. You can see that the tetrad managers would hoik up Lynch in 1990, whether they put him in dead air or not. They're hoiking him up because he's dealing with the last gasp of matching, which is the apocalyptic scenario. That's the Antichrist, you know, the false prophets.
Yeah,
all that resonates, the Satanism, the concern with what Jesus said don't get involved in, with, which was the psychic, right?
Yeah.
So the Antichrist would hoik that up, and especially with the UFO scenario, the saviors. So I can see why Lynch would resonate with the concerns right now. I see it's all pre-programmed to have Lynch be successful in 1990 because it was pre-programmed to have what's happening in the fall around the world, you know, the collapse of this and that government and warlike situations, all nostalgic retrievals of a new environment happening right now. Because if you put Bob on the air and present him as an anti-Bob, as a violent Bob, then
this is the day
you can keep the game going for another 22 months, let's say.
22 months.
Yeah, what would that be from now? That'd be 2 years. That'd be the fall of 1992, right?
Yeah, so that's getting into the presidential election.
Yeah, August 92. Ooh, that'll be a powerful time for me because that'll be the last gasp of the anti-Bob energies.
Oh. So you don't think the picnic on July 22nd, 92 is... Well...
Okay, I said I might be able to make that one. I don't think I can make the 91.
And we will overcome it. If,
I can't make the 91. I'll be in the middle of the fire. Okay, and I think Jerry once mentioned 1992, Bob. 1992, Bob. He yelled at the end of a show. I think it was the July 11th show. Okay.
I full.
Thanks, Ed.
Good night.
We have to get the archives to check this out. Mike, where do you get this stuff? This background Bob stuff. Is this George again?
It's the archives.
Okay.
So two callers in the span of
an hour and a half.
90 minutes, a slow show, but informative, as always.
Yeah, necessary, because we're miming the seminar going on right now. Did you notice the Moscow agent walked into Hussein's parlor earlier this week, maybe the end of last week? Now, this is real interesting. He came with a proposal and softened up in the Moscow-Baghdad relations. I think we can look to that Moscow agent as going to worm around in Hussein's parlor, and you just might see Hussein being offed in the next couple of weeks.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Because he came with a Trojan horse. He was beaming rather evil-like, looking like Dick Dobbs, and Hussein was just glad to have anybody come into his parlor from outside his country. So let's watch for that. Next caller?
Yeah, we should just Okay, we've got 30 minutes left. This is the Church of the Subgenius radio show. You're listening to CKLN 88.1 in Toronto. Did you want a wet towel or anything? Or you want
to
just...
No, this is not like 2 weeks ago. See, that show was a fast-paced, excellent, high-tech show. This is the after-image, the contemplative show.
Well, we're going to keep going here. My name is Michael Dyer. Across from me is J.R. Bob Dobbs. This is the real Church of the Subgenius, for those who have been asking.
And remember, we'll be frenetic next week.
Yeah,
so.
And next week, fundraising. So we rely
on right
on
time. We're supposed to be the mood we are tonight.
Yeah.
This
yeah,
is the mood.
So we'll flip into our our hyper.
Well, we call the spirit of that first guest on our show, wherever he was, wherever that guy was.
But
from the
island. Big week next week, and we hope you'll all listen and come down during fundraising to CK Allen. So let's go to another call. Hello.
Hello, Bob.
Oh, is that Sean?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, my God. He's back from Germany. Oh, my Bob. Sorry. You went to Berlin, didn't you?
Yeah, I was in Berlin.
So you missed the Exodus press conference?
Yeah, I missed all that.
Well, you can buy it all next week.
Yeah, I'll buy it.
Fundraising, yeah. Yeah, we've been calling out for you, Sean.
Have you?
Yeah,
I just got back on Monday.
Yeah, you were away all summer, and then I called you a couple of weeks ago, and you had gone to Germany.
Yeah.
So you prophesied that in your own New Year's Eve firewalk dance last New Year's Eve. You built a wall and knocked it over, right?
Yeah, I said I'd be there for it.
So what happened? What do you make of it?
What happened on the Berlin party?
What happened to you? What do you got to tell us?
Oh, man. It's been a long time. It's been 4 months. Jeez. I could tell you a lot of stuff, I guess. Yeah, I went to the party. It was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. When was that? The October 3rd?
Yeah, October 2nd, actually, was when stuff was going on.
Well, you know, you were celebrating with LaRouche because LaRouche got the notice on October 1st that the government backs down on all the charges it threw at him. They've decided that they won't appeal the two judges' decision to say that LaRouche was framed and based up on fraudulent charges. Now, they got that notice on October 1st, and I asked them, did you guys party? And they said, no, we partied on October 3rd to celebrate the unification of Germany. Does this confirm that LaRouche is a Nazi agent, a Fourth Reich agent? Well, you partied with them. You were over there.
Yeah, well.
What happened?
A lot of people. They dropped a car. did you ever see that thing in the news over here?
No.
They had this, I guess it was sort of an art exhibit of some sort, where they had a car raised up on a crane, and it was like an East German car, and people were shooting fireworks at it all night, and it was hung over a piece of the Berlin Wall that was still left over. And they kept it up there until about 12:30 or so after this fireworks display. And everyone was expecting them to drop it down, just like they do at New Year's Eve in New York with the glass apple. But they didn't drop it down. It was pretty anticlimactic. They just sort of lowered it really slowly, and then the Germans just flattened it. They hopped on it and flattened it. So,
But they're more cautious.
Pardon?
They're more cautious.
The Germans?
Well, they are with that ritual. They didn't drop it.
No, they didn't, no.
They were too cautious?
They lowered it very carefully.
So you're good at percepts. What's your percept from all this 4 months down the way?
Oh, Jesus.
No, give us one.
What do you want a percept on, Germany?
No, well, what's the deepest one in you? Maybe the one that's hardest to talk about.
Okay, well, I just went on media fast for about 4 months.
Yeah?
I haven't had television, newspapers, radio, nothing. So I slowed down quite a bit from what I was before.
Yeah?
But I took a break from Bob for 4 months.
Yeah.
I needed that. Bit of health there. So I don't know what you guys have been talking about. I heard this first bit about Twin Peaks, and I personally never watched the show. it sounded like a, you know, Siskel and Ebert show here. Everyone talking about the aspects of Twin Peaks.
Well, you'd be more interested if you knew it was actually a documentary on what we're doing here at CKLN. You can't believe it. It's all about Bob and killing people.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah? But you were saying that it's no good anymore.
Oh, no, I think it's good. No, yeah, we didn't finish that point. The caller says it won't last past the second series, but I'm saying that the real subgeniuses are into it now because it's obvious what it's really about, and it's significant. Of course, the Pinks can't stand it. They're not going to watch it, so the ratings go down. This is a good sign. It's going homeopathic, so to speak. But I know some subgeniuses who can't wait till next Saturday to see what happens next because it's going to confirm what they've heard here on the show. So it's we're excited by it. It's just the Pinks can't take it.
Oh, okay.
And they knew what was coming up, so they put it under the dead spot. But the subgeniuses like Mike and that, we're taping it, we're studying it, and it's confirming our realities.
Oh, okay. Are you going to make a new Holy Office then?
No. David Lynch is playing strictly catch-up. It goes to me. I mean, look at Laura Palmer, her birthday, July 22nd, 1972. That's already a very important date for the Marshall McLuhan and Mae Russell Holy Office. So no problem. Lynch is not further along the path than me. He's playing catch-up, and, of course, a lot of people are going to wait for that amazing interview when Bob Marshall interviews David Lynch. That'll be off and awful.
Hey,
awesome.
Hey, Bob, what do you think is going to happen to Cole and Helmut Kohl. He has to go up for re-election soon.
Yeah, he probably
will. Are you going to give him the okay, or are you going to kick him out?
We're kicking him out because...
what I would have said today, kick the guy out.
You see, there's already a heavy consensus in Europe that this United Europe, this Fortress Europe, this reunification has incredible disservices.
Mm-hmm.
So the revolution we saw in 89, the slack of consolidation this year is going to be sped up. We're going to have more excitement and demandings and rebellions against whatever images of dominance are projected. It's going to be turmoil in Europe for the next 8 years, probably. And you're going to be looking back and say, Cole was a hero for 15 seconds, you know? And then on to the next guy.
Yeah, Cole just happened to catch the last minute of it, but he's a putz.
Yeah, you got the old leftist gorillas out there running around causing trouble.
They were throwing bombs around and burning cars.
Did you see any?
I didn't catch them. We missed them because... there were so many police there, it was unbelievable.
See, you in a second.
I mean, they had an army set up because, see, what they were doing was they were setting up their own little wall there that night with the police. They surrounded us all and kept us pretty quiet, so.
It's pretty obvious to the world this whole scenario of 1989 was a colossal hoax. The world government can't work, it's obsolete.
Hey, I had to ask you this, though. Okay, who did you use to set up that reunification there? Because there were some signs there that looked kind of suspicious.
You mean what person did I use?
What sort of organizations were operating that thing behind the scenes there?
It was...
you had some help from Gorbachev, right? But he was the ones who were operating from East Germany and West Germany.
Yeah, you see, on the Secret Council 10, the three other people I ran against in February 88 were Prince Charles. These are members of the Secret Council 10, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you'd heard the Exus reading last 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. you would have heard the Exus tell us that there were 10 people involved in what I'm talking about, concerned about this new solar government apparatus they're bringing in. They
mm-hmm.
named 10. Now, we know that's the Secret Council 10, all right?
Okay.
And on three of the other members are Prince Charles, Prince Turnin-Taxis, in Germany, and the Romanov gang, not related to the Romanov family of the Tsar at the turn of the century in Russia, but a name that resonates with that. But Romanov is the backer of Gorbachev on the Secret Council 10, all right?
Mm-hmm.
The German action was totally organized by Prince Johannes Turnin-Taxis. And when mm-hmm. he met with LaRouche and Helga in 1982
mm-hmm.
at one of his 10 castles, he's got many castles, 6 to 10 castles in Europe, he told LaRouche and his wife Helga that if they keep up the kind of information they were putting out, he would do away with them.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several assassination attempts on Helga in the September and the fall of 82. They didn't succeed. But anyways, Turnin-Taxis is the guy behind the scenes in Europe right now, and that's why the Arabs are getting nervous, and that's why the United States had to go into the Middle East, and more to come about that later.
Yeah, I saw a field office of Turnin-Taxis down in Munich. He's got, you know, their little banks there, Turnin-Taxis.
Yeah, so is that the guy that you say you saw? Or what do you mean by the signs?
Well, I didn't see him personally, but there's another thing there. They were handing out these pins on the East German side of the gate, right? We were right at the gate there.
Yeah.
And as you walk through the gate, there's a bunch of guys there, and they had these big, sort of like those recycling boxes that we have around Toronto, right?
Yeah.
They had these big boxes full of pins, and there was no indication of who had printed these pins, and all it said was, you can talk with me. But the symbol on it looked suspiciously like the old eye in the pyramid, sort of a logo, stylized logo of the old eye in the pyramid from the, you know, the Priory de Sion and all that.
The Priory of Sion, the Illuminati symbol that Wilson makes a lot of, Robert Anton Wilson.
So I'm wondering if, like, that was a ploy to make people think, okay, this is the old the Illuminati group running it, or... To shift attention away from the Secret Council of Ten, right?
Yeah, well, the Secret Council...
He set up a fall guy.
That's accurate analysis. See, the solar government runs this whole scene. The world government's obsolete, so the solar government will wake up the fear of the world government at the same time the inevitability of it,
mm-hmm.
all right, to create this distraction, red herring from the real action operated by tetratic structures out of management on the Secret Council of Ten, the solar theater level, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. They're gonna wake up and make it obviously the old world government archetype, the old mm-hmm. Archetypal image of the Illuminati. They're going to make that obvious to people.
Yeah.
And
what that book, The Messianic Legacy, was about.
Yeah.
They were trying to hike up that the United Europe concept was hatched with the world government and not the solar government.
Right, and so we're going to go through so many changes. As the X's say, the definition of the Second Coming is perpetual change, and this is entirely possible under the electric effect of fire, or the mm-hmm. fire effect of electricity, that by 1992 we'll have exhausted this whole United Europe world government scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll get really close to Bob Rule at that point,
mm-hmm.
which is just exposing the fact that I rule already through the solar government, and then we move into universal government propaganda, and then we move into mythic government, which are, that's from 1990 to 2020. Now, I spelled out that 2 weeks ago, and you missed that, but
mm-hmm.
you check the archives, you can understand that.
Yeah.
So mythic government is what we're in now, and I have to go through these layers, peel them away to show what's happening under mythic government, what it is.
Yeah. You know, here's an interesting footnote to that, the European unity concept. They're going to have, since they're throwing down all the borders in Europe, right, they're all dealing with this problem of what are they going to do with Holland because of they've got legalized drugs there, right?
Yeah.
So what happens when you open up the borders and there's no custom guards anymore? With the countries where it is illegal, right, they can't just ignore it. So that's a serious problem for them because they don't know what to do about it. So I would say that might be dealing with the concept of the inner self, right? You know, the inner world, trying to deal with it on a world government level.
Yeah, yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah, the management of inner space.
Yeah, they have to deal with that. And if you go to Amsterdam, everything's do your own thing and do whatever it is and don't worry about the governments and
stuff. Well, that's part of the universal government structure because the universe is the inner dimensions as well as the outer dimensions, right?
Mm-hmm.
It goes further than the solar government structure. So, yeah, that's a universal government concern to deal with inner space. But all previous structures and governments try to deal with it.
But if you're going to lay on that to some world government propaganda, then they'll probably have to make drugs illegal then in Holland as well.
Well,
rather than let it go.
And what?
Rather than let it go and let it spread through Europe because they're not ready for that quite yet.
Well, as we have more electric technologies to play with, we don't need drugs as much. We're
mm-hmm.
finding the electric environment quite addictive. So the world government can use that as an agenda, stamp out drugs as an obsolete program.
They seem they're going to have to start working on stamp out video games. And
That's solar government work.
Yeah.
And then the universal government work is maybe what Lynch is getting at, dealing with the psychic and mm-hmm. how to rule the psychic.
So you know what's going to happen then with the solar government? Okay, the world government's stamping out drugs, the war on drugs, but the solar government's going to have a war on electronics,
video game addicts. Yeah, a pink version of media ecology.
Yeah, because they're going to have this thing about, they're going to declare video games as a legalized addiction, right? The same as alcoholism, and television will be a real addiction, and so they're going to stamp out the evil of television and video games because it's drawing our kids into video game parlors instead of school where they should be, right?
Well, they'll see enough once the world government structure is obsolete, and as we change our percepts rapidly, they'll begin to get the process pattern recognition of seeing what McLuhan was talking about, the effects of the electric environment. That'll become a cliche situation. They'll turn that book, Four Arguments Against Television, into a Bible. Marshall McLuhan hated that book because he was beyond that. But the you can see where they're going to try to use McLuhan and move from eco-fascism into media fascism.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So what is the psychic control?
Psychic fascism?
You see, that's what Dave, the old dialoguer about the psychic was more powerful than the electric, right? Remember Dave, the food guy, Baldwin Foods. Was he dealing with a universal government problem? You know, in the sense of how do you have psychic ecology?
Yeah, psychic ecology. Well, that's like the war between the Axis and the Rai.
Ah, good point. The battle between the cosmic awareness and
you might get back to sort of a Darwinism thing of the survival of the fittest, and so that you've got the fittest psychics cleaning up the backyard for us all.
Well, it becomes a battle over what is consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the battle between cosmic awareness and the evergreens.
Yeah, you look at Toronto, and it's just swamped with all these...
Okay, now what's these interpreters?
Yeah,
psychics. Now this universal government is already being acted out. As I said, it was locked down from 1960 to 1977.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is mythic government ecology? What will be the mythic government, which comes after the universal government situation? See, mythic government is realizing consciousness is in the apparatus you use. The cyberpunk dimly perceives this with this virtual reality addiction and fetish, right?
Mm-hmm.
They realize that technology is a drug or is a stimulator of consciousness. So we don't know where the conscious becomes. It no longer will be a battle between the conscious and the unconscious. It'll become whether you perceive something or not, and then the quality of that perception, and you'll need an object, an environment to perceive something.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a battle of sensory awareness. What?
Yeah, it'll be a battle of awareness, of sensual awareness.
Of consciousness, the forms of consciousness, the external environment becomes mythic again, becomes archetypal. Yeah, this is, see,
Sean. They'll be fighting about total environment, like the surrounding environment, as opposed to, you know, items.
Well, people will become their automobiles or whatever technology is available. They'll hoik that up as the real source of consciousness. Humans will willingly defect into technological matter. Sean, I have to give you a credit for this. You haven't even heard us lay this map out in two shows ago. And Mike, this guy's stimulating a new dialogue about these structures already. This is very good, Sean.
I saw this. I can't remember where I saw it, but it was in a German newspaper or something. But the Pinks have got like a physical prototype for that cyberpunk thing with the total immersion in cyberspace.
Yeah,
they're using it down at NASA now for training pilots. They create a three-dimensional hologramic image that with total environmental surroundings.
Well, that's what Mondo 2000 is promoting. The people who developed that have now marketed that for private consumption. You now can do that with your own goggles.
The Pink's got to act that out. They can't they can't just, you know, with it. They have to create some. The same thing with the, you know, what you were saying a long time ago about time travel. You were saying that to the Canadian Beaver there.
Yeah, that language is time travel.
With a time machine because they don't realize that
language is time. Now this comes, since man is language, and we now define all technologies from speech to zippers to bulldozers to virtual reality technologies as linguistic, and language is myth, because the original meaning of myth was word. So languages and technologies are words. Words are myth. That's what I mean by mythic government. The mythic battle is what word, what technology, as they merge, are you going to put on?
So it's like a battle of words there.
Battle of clothing.
That's what the exes were talking about in their latest, bulletin. You know, they send out their memos.
Yeah.
They were talking about that in their latest memo.
About what?
Language. What is language? And the use of language to create total environments in the self.
Yeah, now that's, is that the core belief engineering?
Yeah, no, it wasn't the core belief engineering. It was, the message from the exes.
Oh, okay, I haven't checked that out. But see, they're trying to putting the matrix, the forming of consciousness. Their bias seems to be that language creates our reality. But I could use a pencil. If I hold up a pencil to define my reality, that a pencil involves and implies so much other aspects of its environment.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we've got to remember that not just speech or thought is language. Your clothing is language.
Yeah.
And it is an organic animal clothing. It's as we wear this electric environment as a new lung, as I've often said.
So every media, but each word is a media as well.
That's right.
You can affect the environment, and that's like the interplay between the medium, the figure-ground relationship, that the words act in a figure-ground.
Excellent. That's
that every time you speak, you're, in dynamic interplay with your ground.
I'll use them in words.
And I think we can interact with the ground of your environment, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this is, therefore, every word evokes every other word. Mm-hmm. Therefore, every technology evokes every other technology. That's why you can't stop technological evolution, because once we had the first technologies, which were whatever you want to say it was, the chicken and egg, all right, gesture or speech, it implied every other subsequent technology. So the evolution of technology is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so if every word invokes every other word and every other technology, then you can just use one word, and that's the word we use, Bob.
Bob, yeah.
See, so that's what Bob's about, and that's what David Lynch is trying to discuss in this Twin Peaks interval question mark with a double-duty and tarot bang thrown in.
Okay, so you've got technologies. Every technology implies every other, and the same goes for word, right?
Yeah.
Does that go with it? So you get an interplay between the two, that every word implies every technology and vice versa.
Yeah.
So that forms almost you've almost got a tetrad there between. Now that's a dynamic. That's not.
Arch the
tongue. Dialectic.
That's a dialectic. We need something with four.
Well, the tetrad is the process of the retrieval. You use one word, it evokes other words.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say the dialectic is a smooth visual space, it's homogeneous.
Mm-hmm.
You say one word evokes all others. Well, the tetrad's a more sophisticated view of that process because it's almost scientific. You look at the word and you see what it particularly evokes of all the possibilities in that particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
What it retrieves, what it obsolescence, what it flips into.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
That's why I was saying that cosmic awareness is lost the battle.
With the evergreens?
Yeah, because the cosmic awareness was caught in that dialectic. They were looking at effects and this battle.
Causes and effects. Yeah, they certainly didn't have the tetrad process, which the evergreens are aware of.
Yeah, because cosmic awareness worked on, exactly that.
And look at cosmic awareness promotes Bill Cooper and the evergreens doesn't.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because That's what I thought was, as soon as I started reading it, that it was, you know, it was kind of fishy sounding.
Right, but remember, every truth...
It sounds so corny, it's cliche, right?
Right, but every truth evokes every error, and every error evokes every truth. So the cosmic awareness has a function.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not saying they don't have a function, I'm just saying that.
But when you're looking from the mountain,
when
you're looking from Bob's view, you put it aside and focus on the evergreens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic, Sean, to talk about this.
Okay.
Okay, Mike's giving the signal.
Yeah, I'll let you go.
So, great return.
You can be around later on, maybe I'll give you a call.
Yeah, we got some good stuff. We got Dan Sheehan talking to Dave Emery.
Okay.
Real good stuff on Kent's show.
Okay.
What's the time, Mike?
10 to 1. 10 to 1.
Oh. Okay, Mike, that was, I think I have to congratulate Sean for performing awesome, very good percepts he evoked immediately after a 4-month fast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think he might be a contender for the Media Ecological Award next week.
For of the month?
No, of the year.
Well, this has been an interesting show. You haven't allowed many calls to come through, so how do you approach the
callers? Take this call?
No, we've had calls waiting all night, though, and a lot of people have hung up, so...
Well, they get their chance next week.
But they don't, though. We've got to keep it, you know.
Oh, listen, we did the fast pace last week. We can't have the same thing.
We've got to have the fast pace every other week, Bob. It's every other week. We've got to
reach out. Yeah, we had the fast pace last week. Okay, last show. Okay, we had a slow pace today. We have the fast pace next week.
But you know, people complain about not being able to get through, and it's because we spend
half an hour on a
week. Well,
we got forever, Mike. We got forever. They should be listening to the subgeniuses who did get through.
Well,
okay, you got to give Sean and these guys. We had new callers tonight, except for Ed. Okay.
We had one new caller. So we had three callers. One of them was a new caller.
Yeah, but Sean was new. Just say, let them give them like 30 seconds.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay,
we lots of callers we lost tonight.
Okay,
Bob,
let's go for the fast-paced show next week. We're going to have some callers. We're going to allow that to happen.
I tried to allow calls all night, actually, and they had to come.
No, but next week during fundraising.
You've been talking too much. Yeah, I think so. Of course, we'll try to work it
There'll
out.
There'll be short calls. There'll be pledges and wisdom.
Of course, there will be.
Okay, the owls are not what they seem. The pledges are not what they seem.
That was the church, I won't call it that, Bob Dobbs and Mike Dyer show from October 10th, 1990. And now we'll go to promos.
Get back the mic. On CKLN 88.1 FM, in honor of March 8th, International Women's Day, women's priorities, contributions, and lives will be the focus of CKLN's programming from Monday, March 6th through Sunday, March 12th. This year's special features include Indigenous Women and Voices of Resistance on Monday from 5 to 10 p.m. On Wednesday, get up early for Working for a Living, Women and Labor from 6 to 11 a.m. Later on Wednesday from 4 to 10 p.m., we feature Liberating the Body with our annual panel on menstruation, interviews on poverty and health, readings from Eve Ensler's Vagina Monologues, and more. And on Saturday, March 11th, we are live from the International Women's Day Rally and Fair. Tune in from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. for energizing and creative messages from women making change in our communities. There's a million reasons to tune in. Full program details are available online at www.ckln.fm. Join CKLN to celebrate International Women's Day from Monday, March 6th through Sunday, March 12th, only on CKLN 88.1 FM, the above ground, underground.
Love to eat? Join Radical Roots Cafe on Friday, March 10th from 1 to 4 p.m. for a menu sampling event. Come and sample scrumptious sweet and savory delights featuring meat-free, dairy-free, and egg-free items from our new catering menu. Admission is free. Tasting tickets start at just $1. Complimentary beverages will also be provided. Radical Roots Catering and Radical Roots Cafe are projects under the Vegetarium Incorporated, a nonprofit organization formed to bring good food to students and the community. Bring a friend and head over to Radical Roots Cafe on Friday, March 10th from 1 to 4 p.m. for delicious treats that you'll love to eat. Radical Roots is located in the International Student Center of the University of Toronto, 33 St. George Street at College, two blocks west of Queen's Park Subway Station. For more information, drop a line to mail@radicalroots.ca.
This event is co-sponsored by CIUT 89.5 and CKLN 88.1 FM.
I want to give a personal endorsement to the Realist magazine. I shouldn't have done that. I want to give a personal endorsement to Radical Roots. Good food over there. I know people who make it. Up next is Mae Brussel with Flo Kennedy. This is from May 6th, 1974.
Jersey newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for 3 years shared with our listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and the abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary relates the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. And now, here's May.
Good afternoon. I'm Dialogue Conspiracy. This is the week that was, as they say. I remember the week that John Kennedy was assassinated. There was a British broadcasting program that said, this is the week that was, and they played a very beautiful commemorative show for John Kennedy. And I think of this week of the news, the Nixon tapes becoming public, the SLA escapades in San Francisco that are as important in American history as the Kennedy assassination, making tremendous social changes backwards if we allow these people to get away with it, and the arrest of the Zebra, that massive arrest of 100 men coming in and taking 7 men in San Francisco, and 4 of them were released for no reason to arrest at all. This huge overkill taking place up there as part of this race war, and so much coming in the news in 1 week, it's almost difficult to comprehend. One of these events alone would take 10 years of work to do, and they're all coming in at one time. And it's hard to summarize, and I'm going to have a few remarks on a couple of passages of those tapes today. But I have a guest today from New York City, a good friend. I consider her a close friend of mine. Flo Kennedy is in Carmel with us. She came out to be here this weekend, and she's going to do a show with me this week on pertinent subjects taking place on the American scene. And Flo?
Hi. You're so modest, you won't tell that we all came down from San Francisco to give you 2 awards. You got the Feminist Humanitarian Award that was given to you by a coalition of women from the Bay Area, and then you got the National Feminist Party Media Workshop Award, and we gave it to you because in 3 weeks you told us more about Watergate than the whole 2 years almost later and multi-million-dollar investigations, quote-unquote, no one of which turned up as much as you did in 3 weeks. And so it's certainly fitting that on this occasion we should have an opportunity to see how far down we've sunk, because those 26 volumes, you brought it to my attention that they came out precisely 26 volumes. What symbolism? Isn't it incredible?
Well, the symbolism of Richard Nixon taking what's the equivalent of a city telephone directory and presenting it to the nation, and while the courts are saying we want the tapes, he had planned for a month to have these things bound. And what my first thing I thought, because I've lived with him so closely, with those 26 volumes, of course, Leon Jaworski of the prosecution of Watergate was a very much a part of the cover-up of the John Kennedy assassination. We have the whole top team of the Kennedy era in power in Washington. You know, Nixon's attorney Jenner.
And don't forget Connally.
Connally. But Nixon's attorney Jenner, Albert Jenner, who's on the impeachment committee,
was
a member of the Warren Commission.
Call the Warren Committee, I'll be all right, commission, the chocolate factory that chocolate coated the manure of the Kennedy assassination.
Oh, it was terrible.
But there was more manure than there was chocolate, so they had to put the balance of it in the archives because they ran out of chocolate.
They ran out of chocolate. Well, I figured, you know, this picture of President Nixon this week holding those 26 volumes, you couldn't count them on the screen, but later the paper this week had a picture of them, the front section of the World, the San Francisco Chronicle, and I had this visual image that he is saying, because, you know, I say the government's run by blackmail or bullets. So that what he was saying was, you have lied in the Kennedy era 10 years ago, and I'm not doing anything different than you, and here's my truth. You have your truth, and I have mine. So I sat down and took a pencil and numbered the volumes, because it looked
and
like
sure
my
enough.
Library. And sure enough, one volume, like volume 20,
only
has
about
3
10 pages. Oh, yes.
14 has 2 pages. He made it symbolic. There's a lot in the symbolism of this.
Oh, there's no question about it. None whatsoever.
He says this is the whole truth, and there's about as much truth in those volumes as there was in the Warren Report.
Of course. And, of course, this had far-reaching effects. But what really got me and why we brought you the awards was that had the article in Paul Krasner's Realist been taken seriously by the AP and the UPI, and if they had not pulled that caper nonsense, then conceivably and almost certainly we would have had a president other than this one, which wouldn't have been a hell of a great thing, but at least we wouldn't have had to spend all the multi-millions of dollars and the multi-millions of hours that the Irvin Committee and all the rest of these uncovering cover-ups, you know, have spent, yielding less information than your article in The Realist yielded 3 weeks after the Watergate break-in.
But one of the things you see, the media can't claim ignorance, because we had a press conference in Los Angeles, the Associated Press, the United Press, and I said, here, Richard Nixon was involved in the Watergate, so was Robert Mardian, so was Patrick Gray, John Mitchell. And this denial that it didn't happen is costing millions and millions of dollars, and they still haven't gotten to the truth of the Watergate Hotel. Sam Dash, he said it isn't important what they were doing there. It makes a hell of a bit of importance what they were doing there. You can't bring a government to a standstill just getting some papers of Larry O'Brien.
And the point is that they've still not raised the question that I think needs to be raised about whether or not there ever was a landslide, because it's my opinion that one of the reasons the Committee to Re-elect the President never shared money with the National Republican Committee as all other presidential candidates did was because they spent the money. Do you remember that reference in the tapes to the $350,000 for polling?
Uh-huh.
What is that about if it couldn't involve the question of simply stealing the election? Put it in better terms than that, but that's what it amounts to. And even if it is not actually the case, it certainly is an area for some investigative journalism, as they keep talking about.
Investigative journalism, they not only had a secret fund, like the Committee Re-Elect the President, which was separate from the Republican Party, but then Patrick O'Brien's brother had a separate front in Maryland with Jeb Magruder that went to the White House, and Haldeman had a $350,000 fund in his desk from Herbert Kalmbach and Segretti, which was the Dirty Tricks Department, which goes through the government. But Haldeman had another separate fund, separate from all of that, and that went into the Wallace shooting. That went into the Mary Jo Kopechne. These are the funds. They don't want to know where they went, because there you find Tony Laskowitz. There was a tape this week that came out about how are we going to cover the Wallace thing, and they talked about the Haldeman money, and they said, we have Tony down there. That's Tony Laskowitz from the Dirty Trick Department.
But when they needed the $350,000, or when they were talking about getting $1 million for Hunt, you remember he said, I don't remember now who had it, but someone had $350,000 for the polling.
Yes, that's right.
And that, what would you be needing that kind of money for polling for, unless you're going to stack the polls? Because you see, the Committee to Re-Elect the President, CREEP, as I always call it, have completely separate operation in every precinct. When I go to Iowa or Bowling Green, Ohio, or just the tiniest town in America, they had separate poll watchers watching, no doubt. And when you see that, and you couple that with the fact that never has there been an election of even a popular president where you have 49 states going in one direction and only one going in the other. But there are newer things that are coming up now. What about the chicken fiasco and massacre?
We can go into the poison chicken. We're buying the right of the president, if it finally gets the impeachment, to not be impeached. That poison chicken deal came out in the newspaper this last week. It was the Chicago Sun had the article in the Washington Post, dated April 21st, or April 19th. And it goes into the fact between 2 million chickens that were poisoned, and the farmers could claim their insurance from whoever sold fertilizer or whatever it was, but they don't intend to. I believe this was purposely poisoned, and then between $8 and $10 million is going to 5 chicken growers. And there was a question brought up even in the newspaper that Nixon is buying off his own impeachment, because by giving these men the money, the senators that raised the money for the farm growers, their constituents are so happy that this 5 men are going to get $2 million each of our tax money.
And of course the children in Detroit and Chicago that were supposed to get those for their school lunches will not get the chicken. They'll probably get paste or something.
No, but what happened is that they did get poison chicken before they caught the poison.
Oh, well, obviously. Well, we know from California that Ronald Reagan, when he was talking about giving the food out in the Hearst situation, referred to giving them botulism. Yes. So food poisoning of the oppressed community is nothing brand new.
But a massive scale like this, where you can give cancer-inducing drugs and, it's going on, but to buy your own impeachment time through the Senate and even have it put in the establishment press, you know, is not a rumor, but a real fear that he's passing out millions of dollars. This is unmarked money, you know, millions of dollars, but this time the taxpayers to pay it, so that these 5 men are sure of the vote and then their constituents get $10 million.
And then right on our own doorstep, you see what seems to some people to be a total flip-flop, where the so-called earlier, at least I thought of the Bay Area as rather a progressive, for America, progressively racist area, and now it's come to be almost like Nazi land.
Well, you see, you had to do that. The Bay Area was McGovern. You know, California is a strange contrast, and you had the birth of the Black Panther Party, the free speech movement, you had the artists and the hippie movement, the Haight-Ashbury, where the children were leaving their establishment homes and realizing the hypocrisy. So that's, if you want to get a runner out of the field, you don't pull his fingernail, you kick him in the ankle and break
exactly.
his leg.
Percent.
So the people where the ideas are coming from, where the most freedom in accepting racial differences and nationalities, the city where the Chinese and Japanese, the Italian and Blacks seem to all melt in, and the youth and the old seem, it's a very free and beautiful city. That's where you hit it, because if you hit them out, then the vocal progression, you know, the rock bands were there, and Janis Joplin, the whole music scene, Jefferson Airplanes and all, you knock that city out and turn it to Reign of Terror, and then you can do the rest of the United States easily.
Obviously, but you see, that's why it's so important that the article that Stephanie Caruana did about with you, the interview, should have gotten out the way it did. And I know it was a great financial sacrifice for you and Stephanie, because you could have gotten a tremendous amount of money for an article of that nature. Instead, you put it into the Berkeley Barb, and now, do you know, there were no Barbs within 2 or 3 days are just wiped out. And I understand, or I hope anyway, that they are talking about doing a special reprint of that article, because that article is almost, you know, out of existence, yeah. And people are just crying and begging for it.
Well, incidentally, if the people are listening and want the, it's called, is SinQ, the SLA SinQ, the next first black Lee Harvey Oswald, the Thunderbird. Here in Carmel has them now. They're selling them. And if people listen to the show out of state,
the last one. Oh, no.
No, they had a pile there.
Oh,
if someone out of state, they can write to KLRB Carmel and send 50 cents. That covers the article, the postage.
I think you better repeat that, because up in San Francisco, they don't even know.
KLRB, May Brussels, KLRB Carmel, California, and ask for the Berkeley Barb article on the SLA and send 50 cents. And I'll send you the article, and that covers the postage in the article. Or the Thunderbird bookstore has them now in Carmel, the Berkeley Barb. A lot of people ask me in town. It's a good, I think it's a good article to explain where the SLA is leading and how it's going into racism and genocide and what these people
and
are
And I think
to.
Before we get away from it, because you really play tricks on me, I'd like you to bring over the awards and let me read what we said on them. We also gave an award to Paul Krasner, the publisher. Let's read the square one first and get them ready for this. Okay, it's the first one from the a coordinated group of women in the Bay Area, and was presented recently to May Brussels by Ona Solon of the Bay Area Association of Household Technicians, that's the domestic workers. It's called a Feminist Humanitarian Award to May Brussels, with our thanks for her devotion to her sisters and brothers of the human race, and it's dated May 1974, Carmel, California. Feminist Party Media Workshop Award is to Mae Brussels for seeing and recognizing the shit before it hit the fan, and for reporting it in August 1972 Realist, what multi-million-dollar government and media wise monkey investigations have admitted but failed to extend. By that, it's a little weird language, but by that we simply mean to say that 3 weeks after the Watergate break-in, she gave us all the information which hasn't really been added to by all these so-called uncoverings. And it's a little ironic that Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein got $55,000 for their book on the Watergate when your stuff was out almost a year before, and I'm glad they got it,
yeah.
And $450,000 for Robert Redford. So I think maybe another thing we need to do is to get your stuff more available, and maybe you and Stephanie will write a film script on Murderville, USA. How is Murderville, USA coming?
Well, there's so many murders I can't get behind the volumes. I'm doing mostly radio work and doing articles, because to get a book down while you're teaching a university class and a radio show. And
I saw your files last night. I can't believe it.
Well, you know, talk about things that are in print in The Realist. We can talk about a specific matter, and then maybe people can follow and write to congressmen and follow this up. You know, the article on the tapes this week, there was a subject of raising the hush money.
Oh, yes.
And they said, can you get $1 million? And the president said, you can get it in cash. I know where it can be gotten. And the question is, who the hell will handle it? And they talk about Tom Pappas from Greece, who could give them the cash.
Nixon had gotten
$6 million. In The Realist article, the first one where I had the press conference,
right.
We talked about Tom Pappas funding this money, this secret money.
Yes, that was
used.
In your Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped?
Then there was
in August 72 of The Realist, right?
August 72 of The Realist. Then there was a question here that many listeners may have missed, but as you get your Watergate tapes in print, look this up. They said, you don't need $1 million right away, but you need $1 million. Is that right? And Dean said, that's right. And the president said, you need it in cash, don't you? I'm thinking out loud here for a moment. Would you put that through the Cuban committee? Dean said, no. Is it going to be checks, cash, money? How will it, if it comes out, are you going to handle it? Is the Cuban committee an obstruction of justice if they want to help? And Dean answered, well, they have the priests. And the president said, would that give it a little bit of a cover?
Mm-hmm.
So the president knows who the priests are, right?
Obviously.
They're having a conversation. So should we talk about who the priests are? Because at my college class last week, I talked about the priests. If you get the second article I did that's also at the Thunderbird bookstore, or you could write to KLRB, on page 22 of The Realist, I talk about William Sullivan, Division 5 of the FBI, and he is the most important liaison of the past political assassinations. And the
Don't
FBI, the governor.
The deleted part right after that.
Oh, yes, we'll go into William Sullivan. But here is a section, page 22. It said, the American Council of Christian Churches, shortly before LBJ
now, this
died.
This is your article.
This is my article in The Realist, page 22. Said, shortly before Johnson died, he revealed a curiosity that caused him to find that the real assassins of President Kennedy came from the Caribbean, called Murder Incorporated, a series of church fronts. Funded as a school for assassins in Oaxaca, Mexico, dressed as missionaries. Now, these men are dressed as priests. The same church people interested in such activities have direct contacts to important White House aides.
Oh, boy.
Seriously, here's Dean this week talking with Nixon about their priests. And I had this last July of 73 in the Realist. It says they have contacts with the FBI, the CIA. Agency money, now listen to this, is sent to churches who pass it to persons they never met and will never meet. The money hires assassins.
And so these, obviously, and your very next item, your very next item is about the Cuban exile group.
Community. Yes, the Cuban exile community. Because a man said on the bus going to Mexico with Oswald by the name of John Howard Bowen, whose alias was Albert Osborne, and he worked with the Cuban committee and with William Sullivan of the FBI and the White House, and they dressed as priests. The man ran a missionary school down in Mexico, and they sent out assassins for Guatemala, Nicaragua, Jordan, Middle East. You know, when Kennedy died, they said, this isn't a domestic assassination. We're not a banana republic. And the same priests were shooting down there that were paid in Washington. And we were buying the banana weapons.
Of course.
See, now here's the name of some churches floated. I won't. Here's a woman's name in Virginia. Now, this is volume 25 of the Warren Commission hearings. I spent years on this, so this is why I could write the article. Here's a woman from Virginia, page 55 of volume 25. Her name is Mrs. Fraley. You can read it up, so I'll read it. Mrs. Virginia Fraley. She met Mr. Bowen 20 years ago. This is an affidavit she signed. She wasn't a witness. She's not seen him until a year and a half ago. She's known 19 and a half years. Some deacon in Knoxville, Tennessee, in September 62, gave him enough money for a mission for 3 years, but it's not sponsored by the Baptist Church. They were dressed as Catholic priests. They're doing missionary work on their own. A Mrs. White in Pikesville, Tennessee, said that she recalled the missionary in Mexico. She sends $35 a month weekly. She never met Bowen. That's the man that sat with Oswald. She's never seen him, only contacts him in the mail. She knows nothing about his background. She gives aid and assistance to any needy person who does the work of the Lord.
Oh, wow.
Now, these are the priests.
Oh,
is that healthy?
Oh,
now, here's George. Do the work of the Lord. Now, these people, I have a list of people that have been sending money down to these churches. Now, this is a CIA front, the federal government. Sends money down to various churches through California, Virginia.
And as usual, the poor people fund it. As usual, the taxpayers and the consumer groups and the church.
No, they're a conduit of money.
No,
yeah.
I know, but I'm just saying that as usual, the little people, some of them possibly sincere, they think they're, really contributing to a church.
Oh, yeah.
Although nobody with taste and brains would do that.
I think that the very richest people can keep track of their money. So I can't believe that these people from Oregon, Washington, Virginia, Tennessee, are just voluntarily sending between $35 and a couple hundred a month to a missionary they've never met.
It's a washing machine.
It's a washing machine.
To clean up the money.
That's right. So they dress as priests, and they go down there. So the Realist article mentions the Murder Incorporated as being missionary churchmen. So when the White House tapes came out this week, there you have the president saying, Dean says, well, they have the priest to cover it. And the president says, would that give a little bit of a cover? And he said that would give some for the Cubans and possibly Hunt, and then you got Liddy. So the president knows about the priest because he doesn't say what priest.
Well, no, he's very au courant with that part of it. But you see, the other end of the spectrum is the Nazis in San Francisco and in the Bay Area. You see, because one thing that the establishment do that we, unfortunately, I don't know who we are, but I assume anti-establishmentarians don't do, is cover each end. You see, they have the priests and they have the Nazis. So when the school or any other situation gets totally out of hand, and the police can't quite deal with it, then they either send, whether it's Wallace's, when Wallace's campaign got out of hand, when the school situation got out of hand, this recent Yvonne Golden episode was one of the things that helped to make them even more visible, then either the priests or the Nazis are available to them.
Oh, wait a minute, I got a better one for you than that, Flo. They could be both, because the same John Howard Bowen, alias Albert Osborne, that sat on the bus with Oswald that ran the school of priests, was arrested in 1942 for being a Nazi in Tennessee and for burning the American flag.
He's come full circle.
He's both a Nazi and a priest.
Oh, boy.
And he's never an ordained minister, but they wear the collar.
Of course.
And they're funded by the Central Intelligence Agency, the taxpayers.
They're Nazis in drag, in other words.
Well, they're Nazis at their campsite and they're priests in Mexico.
Of course.
And he travels and men of the church.
And they use whatever cover they happen to want.
They have three ways. They can be Nazi and priest or Nazi.
That's right.
But they're all the same. The FBI knows these people. If I have all these records on them, they can certainly begin to figure this out, unless they're funding them, which they are.
But you see, the peculiar thing is that the Nazis killed 6 million people, and they've turned up in the Bay Area, and no one seems afraid of Nazis. But purportedly, and we don't act, I have never seen a body of a white person killed by a black man, but I'll stipulate that it's happened. But 12 white people are supposed to have been killed by black people, and they have a zebra fright up there that it's bordering on psychosis. And what I can't understand is, how is it that there's never enough evidence to make some people believe that Nixon is guilty, but there's never so little evidence that they won't believe that a black person is guilty of anything from grinding white people up as hamburger and serving it to each other or whatever, you see? And it's that kind of pathology that you're dealing with here. Because, you see, we don't get any radiation at all from the Nazi situation. No one seems to believe, not even Jews seem to be the least bit scared that the Nazis might repeat what they did in Nazi Germany. But they're prepared to put the whole black community in a position of responsibility, searching cards issued of South African methods, breaking down doors, holding people in jail. And did you see what they did to the Muslim headquarters of those people? Gail Christian did a story on NBC that showed the damage and destruction of this little pitiful place that the Muslims had. And they dragged, and then of course they sent four of them back because they didn't have sufficient evidence, but made very certain to announce that if they should get a little bit of evidence, you know, they know they only need about a teaspoonful, whereas they got to have a mountain range of evidence for Nixon, or people are still making excuses.
I know. Well, you know, there's another thing in the White House memo this week, which was very interesting because it goes along with this thing. When the president and John Dean are having a talk about how to cover up in the Oval Office, March 13th, 1973, and they're saying, in reference to the allegiance of FBI former official William Sullivan, and this is what Dean says, if I have one liability in Sullivan here, it is his knowledge of the earlier...
unintelligible, boy.
...blank that occurred here.
Want to guess what that's all about?
But William Sullivan was not only, according to news memos, on the secret police force of the White House, you know, that Intertel, co-Intertel program, but when he was asked about
FBI
if he approved of it...
FBI assistant director, wow.
Yeah, he was assistant director of the FBI, and they asked him if he approved of this domestic program... He said, I approve of it 1,001%, and I was responsible for it.
Boy.
And in my article in The Realist, I said that he was behind the political assassinations of Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and John Kennedy. And 10 years later, he bragged, how could he be 1,001%? And he claims responsibility. And he claims that he even took things from J. Edgar Hoover's desk and did things over his head. And at the time of the Watergate arrest, William Sullivan had taken from Hoover's desk things that John Mitchell and Nixon information that would have kept them from being president, and they were in John Ehrlichman's desk. If the media had listened to what I said, we wouldn't have an election because all of this information was available. How can you elect a man in who has things in his secretary's desk that prove that he isn't fit to be president?
Obviously. And what is this dialogue about whether you need a crime for impeachment? Whether you need it or not, you've got about two dozen.
Well, just stealing from the J. Edgar Hoover, putting
it
in your own desk.
Well, obstructing justice and accessory after the fact, and perjuring at least 100 times, but say 20, and harboring criminals, withholding evidence, obstructing justice through misleading evidence, refusing to respond to a subpoena.
Well,
there's
a list of 57 impeachment charges.
Oh,
did you
please.
Know that?
And don't forget that had they responded appropriately to your material in 1972, that's very nearly 2 years, just 6 weeks or so before it'll be 2 years, they would not have had certain key people like Chotiner dead.
Oh.
And, well, there have been about five deaths of people that really should have been questioned immediately in 1972.
You know, the way I concluded my article, and this was July 72, there were two paragraphs or sentences that I think are important, because I wrote this, it'll be 2 years ago in two
That's
months.
That's right.
I said, high, and I talked about Alger Hiss, because he's talking about his name on the tapes. I said, high summit meetings, a false sense of euphoria preceding elections does not conceal increased budgets for weaponry, new laws of repression, or further concentration of power in the White House. The family of humanity is not represented by the strategists who are few in number, still holding on to their power. Secret organizations such as the Lincoln Club, formed in 63, continue to finance and dictate to Richard Nixon that groups should be carefully examined. Nixon's kind of power over other people's lives is elusive and vanishes rapidly at the proper moment. The human family, and that's why I like your humanist award, the human family has new weapons in the war against secrecy. Information is power. Speed of communications is power. Ability is power. Sheer numbers of intelligent and concerned citizens become power. And facts are power.
And I noticed in your mail this morning, when you got such a tremendous amount of mail from Seattle. You know, when I traveled up there in connection with the schools, and I hear you're going to be hitting the campus trail, I find that there are groups in every state that are prepared to go after these senators so that they will not feel free to be so sure they're going to let Nixon off. And I think it would be very interesting, whenever possible, for instance, when you go to Seattle or when you go to a certain state where the senator is shaky where he's getting a payoff. For instance, Scoop Jackson carried the ball for the Trident missile submarine, which is $13 billion, you see, and they are vetoing bills for daycare and food programs. So I think it's important that the people from those states begin to take positions that and make it known to their senators that they're going to dump them.
And become intelligent of their own lives.
Right.
The
in
facts
words,
are out if they use
right.
them.
That's right. And that they don't just ask you what they can do, but they get on these senators
get
because there are
only
96 of them.
That's what
and
I
they've
said.
Got millions and millions of dollars.
Write letters,
we just have
talk
to
shows.
Let them know this is the end of the line for them.
In
if
other
they
words,
don't
you
vote
have,
for impeachment.
You don't appeal to the senator, you appeal to the people that take on talk shows, write
exactly.
letters to the editors. You know, Flo, you are a fighter. That article Stephanie did about you, the warrior.
Compared
the warrior.
To you, I'm a worm, honey.
No. It's all, we're all out there in the front trying to expose conditions that are wrong. We know they've always been wrong, but there's always a chance with the intelligence and know-how today to make them better, so that's no excuse anymore.
But you see, we have on our side at this moment the desperation. They have not time to clean up the ship and get it together. So the thing we need to do now, I think, is to really to crowd them. You see, Nixon is being crowded. These tapes, the release and publication of these tapes are a terrible error. There are a lot of very square and wonderful people who would never be anti-establishmentarian, but these tapes are shocking. And what I believe we can do now is to get larger cadres of people ready to require their senators to make commitments. And they expect this to run into September, so we have plenty of time, May, to get to the people all summer long on your show, on the campuses, through our mailing lists, which are very limited, with the articles that people like you and Stephanie Caruana are doing. And you see, the point is that because of their desperation, each state is going to have its own program of repression. The Zebra and the SLA scare has got people in a very nervous state of mind. But on the other hand, more and more young people are becoming anti-establishmentarian. And Patty Hearst is, I think, just the beginning. And I think there'll be an epidemic. You pointed out in the Berkeley Barb article how the kidnapping is a softening process to make people accept people's disappearance and vanishing.
Mm-hmm.
We have continually to let the people understand, and by talking to them this way, they will be more and more skeptical of the government. You see, we've yielded the right to violence to a racist, genocidal, militaristic, corrupt, assassination-prone society and government.
One bet on death.
What we have to do now is to make people aware of that so they'll begin to make their own connections and they won't have to refer to people
and
like
their own life forces. We see what I do. Wherever I speak, I give out a bibliography of about 30 essential books. And people are buying these books. And they write, you saw the mail today, people ask for the bibliography. And I say, well, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you all I know. I'm not a sideshow. You're going to invest your own eyes, your own time and money, and get knowledge and information. Then you write letters and you take pressure. You say, look, this is what I know. What are you going to do about it? Like,
but I noticed from your mail that in addition to people who want you to tell them what to do, you get mail from people who are telling you what is happening.
Yes.
You see, on the army bases,
in the
question of the psychosurgery. And then people like Peter Bregan and Mary Lou Shields in Boston are beginning. So you see, the polka dots of the oppressed are running together, too.
They're,
and while we don't have the wherewithal to pull what they're pulling, since they're in the wrong, we don't need as much.
See, the one thing we have on our side, like, as you say, they're in the wrong, is that if I had told somebody 3 years ago that you would see John Mitchell and Patrick Gray and Robert Marty and all these people out, or Agnew.
And Eagle Crow.
See, they break laws, and people say to me, are you afraid? You see, I don't break anything, and I don't steal anything, so I could just go forward, and I don't have to worry about who knows something. I mean, they all are in a position. If you hear those tapes.
And you see, the fact is now that there is a certain amount of searching going on, even though it's there's as much cover-up as there's searching.
Exposure,
you see, certain people are beginning to attach their claim to progress on revealing these things.
You see, we give the lectures, they're paying money now to hear how corrupt other people
exactly.
are.
Exactly, but the prosecutors are beginning to see that you can make a big name for yourself, not just prosecuting little people, but prosecuting big people. And of course, your suggestion that people look into the jury that Freed stands and Mitchell is fine, but I don't even mind that so much, because what I find is people get so frustrated when they have the kind of evidence and see the kind of evidence they have on Stans and Mitchell and watch them get away and then see how quickly and with what dispatch they can just pick up people, tear up their houses, break up their places and their shops. Then they begin to get more and more angry. So as far as I'm concerned, they can't do right even when they do right, and they can't do wrong even when they do wrong, because we get them either way it goes.
Either way, you can't get upset that Mitchell and Stans got off, because when you think that John Mitchell was the most important lawyer in the country, the head of the Attorney General and New York lawyer, the prosecution can't afford to present evidence that he looks guilty, because then he comes back. He's not going to go to jail without talking about the president. They're double blackmailing each other, so you know they have to have a weak prosecution.
Did you know that Judge Gagliardi, that handled that trial, had held Joanne Chesimard's aunt, who was also her attorney, in contempt for refusing to go forward with their trial on about a week's notice? And that was how I got stuck defending Joanne Chesimard, when I never did criminal work ever in my whole career to any extent. And they were so desperate that they had me handling her trial when I was home at Christmas.
Well, you know, the trial of Hugo Bunnell out in Salinas, he had a well-known lawyer up in Northern California was going to take his case, and the lawyer was tied up on another case, and the judge says, we have to go to trial this week, and wouldn't give him another date, and gave him a public defender 2 days on a murder trial of killing a guard. And, you know, they rushed those
things. But you see, this is typical. But you see, now, one of the things I think that we should be aware of is that that the president is getting paid at the rate of $200,000 a year while he's fiddling and diddling around refusing evidence. On the other hand, they're saying we want Watergate behind us, and yet he's trying to stretch this so that you'll have the problem of a second Congress having to hear this evidence.
Well,
and the other thing I think that people should do, excuse me, just 1 second, is to force them to move ahead and say that we're going to have dump Senator X in our state if that trial doesn't begin EON standard. Because the idea of paying Democrats a salary, regardless if it was $2,000 a year, he should be off the payroll. And here he is holding up the investigation, demanding speed.
Of course, there's one good thing about that, Flo. As long as Nixon's in the White House, and I, in a way, kind of think he should be there the remaining four years.
Yeah, well, there's two schools of thought. I know.
See, this reason, I've spent 10 years going over the Warren Commission lies, and I know that Gerald Ford is so guilty of a cover-up, he's worse than any Ehrlichman, Haldeman, Dean, all rolled together. So what the kind of mentality in news media that the Pentagon pushes out would do this. If Nixon were out tomorrow, they'd say, now that we have Ford, let's give him a clean chance for American security. Let's not go into the past, because the past is the past. The past is the present, and, you know, the sugar you eat today is going to rot your teeth 10 years from now.
I appreciate that strategy, but my point is simply that they're going to do what they do either way. So your strategy says even if he stays in, it's good for us.
Because, you see, the longer he's in, this is the point. If he's out, they say you can't whip a dead horse. Like, they let Agnew out so fast, he had 40 charges against him, and they let him out with one. So I think you should take the position of letting Nixon in and keep whipping it up on
him.
But
you see, the way I do it, I call it sort of a jujitsu. Whichever way their weight goes, mine goes with it. If he's out in a hurry, some of us can press. They're going to drag their feet anyway.
Yeah.
So some of us should press for him to be out, because he has no business in there.
But some
other people should have pressed for him to stay in, so that either way they go, there would be a substantial contingent of people prepared to proceed on the outcome.
I'm afraid they'll lose their vigilance once they get a new house in there. That's why I would rather dangle it and bring everything out of that, because they'll lose
their
vigilance.
Well, they are taking care of that for you. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Their strategy is to drag their feet.
Yeah.
So our strategy can work in with theirs where it does, and can work against them where it does not. That's all I mean.
And call attention to these. Well, listen, our time is up. I really appreciate your coming to see us, and I'm sorry it's over so fast, but we'll be together in, I see we have more time.
Do we really? Yeah, we got 7 more minutes.
We got some then we'll talk.
Oh, great.
Here's my reason about keeping Nixon on. If Agnew were still vice president, and you went in this long thing about him, and you didn't let him out on a slap of the wrist, he's going out, Mr. Virtue is writing these little phony little sexy books, or a form of a blackmail too, what he's writing there. He should stay in and have the 40 counts against him. If he did 40 illegal things, we should have heard all 40. Because now everybody says Agnew only did one thing, and the media crucified him, and he got out on one little thing when he was not even the vice president, you know, in Maryland. And the point is, let the public know all the things they do, because then they couldn't come back later and say the media crucified Agnew. They could say he was out on 40 charges, and here they are. Now, if Nixon had resigned, like I have an article from the Washington Post, New York Times, a list of 56 impeachable charges against Nixon, and one of them is the plumbers. Well, that pertains to all your secret murders, assassinations, tricky departments, so you know what the other 54 or 53 are. But if Nixon had resigned a month after the Watergate, we still
all
wouldn't have had all of this.
Covered.
So the
but
long
you see, reason, they are working on your end of it. They are working to stall it. So my position is, I like to have a parenthetical strategy where you are rushing them and you're holding them back at the same time. Obviously, we are not going to determine whether he ends the term in the White House. The chances are that is his whole strategy. So you might have your way with his cooperation. My point is, for those people, and I know there are many of them who think as I do, although I agree that, you know, the other strategy is a perfectly acceptable one, as I see it, we must teach politicians that they cannot string things out and have things their own way and determine what's going to be subpoenaed and so forth. So they are working on...
That was Flo Kennedy in conversation with host Mae Brussel way back May 6th, 1974, in the midst of the Watergate fiasco for Nixon. Well, he did get kicked out, but reasons why that happened are even unclear today. So next up is Sambra Doris. That was part of that Flo Kennedy, Mae Brussel was part of our International Women's Day programming, and we're going to continue that next week. Stay tuned for that and for a whole week of International Women's Day programming. Things going well over in Afghanistan, I hear on the news. So with the Canadian forces, everything going according to plan. So that's all from me on the International Connection. Up next is Sambra Doris. If you want to visit our website, www.ckln.fm/tilde International Connection. I've been your host, Greg Duffel, with Daniel Becheret. Bye for this week.
March 11, 2006, Kid Rasta and Association.